Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted, and I really mean that, to be in conversation today with Gretchen Holbrook-Gruzina, known to many WAMC listeners as the former host of the book show on WAMC. Gretchen joined the Commonwealth Honors College at the University of Massachusetts Amherst as dean on July 1st, 2015, after 10 years as a named professor at Dartmouth College, where she held the Kathy Tapper Vernon Professorship in Biography and served as chair of the English Department and later as chair of African and African American Studies. Previously, she spent 14 years as a professor of English at Vassar College, followed by 2 years as a professor and director of Africana Studies at Barnard College, Columbia University. She holds a PhD from Stanford University, an MA from Simmons College, and a BA from Marlborough College. Gretchen Gruzina has written 7 books, most of them historically grounded biographical studies, which have been widely reviewed. Her most recent book, Mr. and Mrs. Prince, How an Extraordinary 18th Century Family Moved Out of Slavery and Into Legend, that was done in 2008, recounts the story of 2 former slaves, Abjah Prince and Lucy Terry Prince, of colonial Massachusetts and Vermont, who became landowners and public figures, successfully defending themselves in court. Gretchen Gruzina was born in Ann Arbor, Michigan, to a white mother and an African-American father whose marriage was illegal in 17 states when they married. They moved with their 2 daughters just before Gretchen turned 5 to Springfield, Massachusetts, where she grew up, always knowing that she wanted to be a writer. More information about Professor Gruzina can be found on her website, www.gretchen, GRETCHENGERZINA, GretchenGruzina.com. Thank you, Gretchen. It is so wonderful and so lovely to have you back with us. Appreciate it so much.
I can't tell you. It feels like home being back in here and often sitting on the other side of the table instead of this side.
Right. You know, you are a hot, hot commodity. I hate to use those terms. But when it comes, You can write your own ticket at any academic institution, it would seem, all over the world.
Well, I have taught outside of America as well.
You at Oxford.
I was at Oxford. Oxford did this wonderful thing for me. They named me the Eastman Professor. They give this professorship to 1 American professor a year, and it's for a year. It's generally been somebody in the sciences, and they chose me as the American professor that year. It was sort of like being like Eliza Doolittle. They give you a 4-bedroom house, a housekeeper. You give a couple of lectures here and there. You sit at high table with the silver and the gowns. Then at the end, they throw you out.
But most people, when they get a tenured professorship, say, okay, this is it for the rest of my life. I'm not giving up my tenured professorship. But with some regularity, you have said, Gretchen, you know, okay, enough of this, on to the next thing. That takes a great deal of confidence, doesn't it?
Well, people think it takes nerve. People think it takes guts. It's a kind of leap of faith. But opportunities come along, and sometimes you think no, and then sometimes something strikes you right. This opportunity at UMass was something that brought me closer to home and to a very different kind of institution that I'd ever worked at before. So I thought, well, why not take that leap? And they are giving me tenure, so I'm not...
Well, of course, you're not going anywhere without tenure. But it is amazing to me. It has always been amazing to me what you have achieved. Tell me about your childhood. Tell me about being a kid. What's your earliest memories?
Oh, well, my earliest memory was of breaking a bed with my sister and I were jumping on it. So that probably doesn't count.
But how old do you think you were?
Oh, I was probably about 3. But we moved to Springfield when I was just about 5.
How come?
Well, you know, there were several reasons. My mother had grown up in Adams, Massachusetts. Her father was the congregational minister for Adams, and she always wanted to go back east. They were living in Michigan when they got married, and they were trying to find a place that would welcome a family like ours. And actually, Ann Arbor, Michigan would have been fine. Yeah. It would have been fine. But she wanted to go back closer to where she'd grown, even though her parents were long gone from there. They had moved to Colorado decades before. And they thought, well, it was an affordable city. And at that time, Springfield was a very different kind of place. It had a really interesting school system. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Springfield Plan, but they allowed people to choose their high school based on what they wanted to do. I went to classical high school. My sister went to tech. There was a commerce and a trade. And they thought that we would not run into the kind of difficulties that a mixed race, interracial family might. Now, it wasn't all heaven. You know, there were issues. My mother went on to get a master's degree at the Hartford Seminary, and when she tried to find a job at a church, she couldn't find a job that would hire her because she had an African-American husband. She couldn't find a church to join because she had an African-American husband. So we grew up in a black congregational church where we were one of two interracial families there. And it was an interesting thing. My mother was very welcomed there. They were very proud of having someone like her. My father got to be an usher, but they never made him the kind of deacon he would have loved to have been. And
what did he do for a living?
Well, he worked in a factory. That was the other interesting thing. He worked in a factory. He never finished high school. It's a long story, but he had to leave 2 months before graduation. And my mother went on and had a graduate degree. I think he was the first black person she ever met. She was putting herself through law school at the University of Michigan, where she'd done her undergraduate work. And she was working nights at a factory. This is not sustainable. You don't work all night at a factory and go to law school all day because there's no time to do your studying. But she found that he was one of the few people who could talk to her. He had come back from the war. He had been married and divorced, and he was kind of, you know, broken, I think, by the war and by his broken marriage. And they liked sports, and he worked at another job at the University of Michigan Hospital, so he had tickets to things, and they would go off to basketball games together. He did report that when they were walking down the street one day, a car drove into a plate glass window when they saw them walking together. If you can imagine the time that would be such a startling thing for them. I asked her where they got their first kiss, and she laughed and said, in the revolving door to a bank. Which seemed odd to me, but...
What did her folks think about?
Oh, well, that's another interesting story. I have letters. Her father begged her not to marry my father, and it was, I think...
And he was the Congregationalist minister.
Yeah.
And the Congregationalists are pretty liberal.
They are, and he was a very wonderful man. I think he was just afraid for her. He knew she'd always been rebellious as a child, so he knew if he told her not to do it, she would do it. So he said, please don't do it, and it will be too hard for you. The life will be too difficult. He's divorced. There are children from that first marriage to support. I think that was their big worry.
We should remember that back then, you know, being in a mixed marriage was certainly going to be an issue, but being a divorced person was another one.
It was like problem on top of problem. So he wrote her a letter and said, please don't do this. I'm begging you not to do it. And I know you're going to do it anyway. So then please don't have children. And don't have children because they will never succeed in the world. And then when she went ahead and did it, they actually did a wonderful thing, which was they got married in a church in Detroit. And my grandfather did the first half of the ceremony, and an African-American minister did the second half.
Yeah.
So it ended up in a really sweet way.
How much of that caution, your kids will never amount to much, basically? Mm. What does that mean to you with having achieved what you've achieved?
You know, I think he just could not envision a time when it would be all right, when they would not be made fun of, when children would not feel as they used to say that you're neither here nor there. I can remember being in junior high school and having teachers tell the class that children of mixed marriages will never feel they belong anywhere in the world. And I was sitting right there thinking, I belong in this room. I have friends. And I think there was a great deal of misunderstanding and fear. A friend in high school who'd been a close friend of mine always assumed, I found out later, that I had spots underneath my clothing. Because she hadn't been able to see them. Because if you're mixed race, you must be, I don't know, like a cow. I don't know what she thought. So I think he had gone through a time, there had been Japanese internment, there had been the Holocaust, there had been a lot of not accepting people in the world. And I think he was afraid for his daughter that she was taking on more than she knew how to handle. And finally, someone said to her, you know, if you marry him, then you will cease to be white. You will be part of the black community. And she said she just thought for a few minutes, and she said, well, okay, that's all right. And as it turned out, everything was all right. You know, they were married for more than 50 years before my father died. Yeah, so it was kind of a thing where you want to just tell them it's okay. I would love to write a letter to my grandfather, who died when I was six, and say, you know, it's okay. It was going to be all right.
That's a great story, but it wasn't quite on target with the question that I asked.
Sorry.
No, the question I asked is, look, here you are, this incredibly successful woman. I mean, beyond anything that most people could ever understand. And you hear the story about don't have kids to your mother because they will have too hard a time in the world. How much of what has happened to you, which is unbelievable, is that you were motivated by that?
Yeah. I think you're wondering whether as a child I actually took that to heart and thought, well, I'm going to prove him wrong, or I'm going to really go ahead and succeed in the world. But I'm not sure it happened that way. For one thing, I didn't see those letters for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I was a bit older that I finally asked my mother, well, what did they think? And then she just sort of said, oh, you don't want to know. You know, they were not happy about it. So I don't think I knew that. But I did know always that I really, really wanted to succeed in the world. I wasn't sure I knew what I wanted to do. Mostly I wanted to lie in the backyard and read books, I think. And I really was motivated, partly because my mother had worked so hard. She'd done a degree when I was in elementary school. I watched her go and do this graduate degree. I went to some classes with her. So she really wanted me to succeed. But then there was my father, who had been kept from the kind of education and life he'd wanted, and he really wanted me to succeed. I think I had that first child burden, you know, that you want to be all things to all people. But I think there was probably a piece of me that felt when I went through school, when people were shocked, that you had parents of different colors from each other, when friends would say, well, how does that work? You know, they wouldn't understand it. I think there was really a part of me that said, let me show you what can be done. Mm. Don't forget also, it was a time when Ed Brooke was the senator.
Indeed.
And there was a different sense of who could be something in the world. But it was also a time when they could take Harry Belafonte and Petula Clark off the air because she touched his arm when they were singing a song. So it was a time of very mixed messages, I think. I suspect a lot of people I grew up with felt very motivated to do something important in the world.
What became of your sister?
My sister lives in Florida right now. She did go back and live in Springfield with my mother. Not a recipe for success always when you have two adults going back, reverting to their earlier time. And we're still really close. We're only 15 months apart.
Wow.
So, yeah, texting, that technology thing gave her a big boost to be anywhere in the world and be in touch with me at least five times a day.
What did she do professionally?
She actually has some health problems, so she's not working now.
Yeah. Gretchen Grazina, I guess the next question is sort of tracing you going through the school system. Now, you know, your achievements are extraordinary, but a PhD early, right?
No, it wasn't that early. Mm. It wasn't that early. I actually took several years off. I graduated from college and then went off and was a secretary at Harvard for a couple of years.
What was that like?
Oh, it was terrible.
Was it?
It wasn't terrible in one sense, but it was the motivator to think, okay, this is not what I need to be doing with my life, and to say I need to do something else. And also, and forgive me all you Harvard graduates, there was a certain kind of arrogance that said,
no.
That made me feel like I am nothing. Even an undergraduate Harvard student ranked higher than I did as a young adult woman with a job. And I switched over to Simmons College when they had started a master's degree program for women in business. And I worked for them and decided that they were all about feminism and women getting ahead in the world. They thought that becoming an English professor was not a good move. They wanted me to go into banking, which wasn't really in my script. And then when I was doing that, I had actually married and I had two small children. Hmm. And finished my master's degree at Simmons and thought, well, maybe I can be doing something else. And I started looking into PhD programs and, to my amazement, was accepted at five of them and chose Stanford. So I went off to do my PhD while I was potty training little ones.
Amazing. What made you go to the Left Coast?
Well, we did this sort of strategically. We figured out where he could work, where his company had offices. And so I applied in places that seemed very mixed. I actually was one of only a few women who started the PhD program there. And then I was certainly one of the only women who had children. And I managed to finish ahead of everyone else because children, as you know, keep you organized. They keep you structured.
Sure.
You don't go hang out and have beer and pizza every night with your friends. You go home and you read to your kids and you put them in bed and then you write a paper.
And they take their naps at the right time.
Well, yeah, they sometimes took naps. They tried.
Right.
Yeah. So that was, it was a wonderful thing living in California. I think my kids thought that I had pulled them off the edge of the earth when we came and moved from there to Clifton Park.
I get it. Now, if you have to compare for us, Gretchen Christina, your priorities, Maslow's descending order, whatever. And you say, okay, I was a mom. I had two children. And I was also doing a PhD, and I was also starting out on this career. Where does having children come in the way you think about your achievements?
Oh, right at the top.
Does it?
Yeah, absolutely. Don't you think so?
Yes.
Right at the top. I think there's a great, wonderful meaning to success and personal success. There's another meaning to having another person who thinks that you're very important to them and to whom you are crucial and whom you can love and nurture and hope to achieve their dreams. And now I have two grandchildren.
Yes.
And I remember just a week or so ago, we were sitting down in Brooklyn, where we spend a lot of time, and
talking. That's where my grandchild is, too.
There you go. And everyone, you have to live in Brooklyn now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a law. But we were sitting having brunch and talking, my son and I, across the table earnestly about something. And I felt this little pressure. And I realized that my 7-year-old grandson had just leaned over and was just sitting there, leaning there next to me because he just felt so cozy and comfortable. And I thought, oh, well, that's what it's about. That's right. I need to get some priorities. They do help you get your priorities straight.
They do. So take me to, you graduate, you have a degree now, a PhD. Mm. For all of us who have PhDs, this was a very difficult time of my life. I don't know about anybody else's.
It was hard. It was hard.
Almost everybody I talked to, if you ask them to identify where they were most crazy, it's usually around there. Was that right with you too?
It was hard. It was hard. It was hard because partly I had gone from one of the smallest undergraduate colleges in the world. Marlboro at that time had only a couple of hundred students. And I went from there to Simmons, which was very nurturing and small. And then all of a sudden I found myself in Stanford with all these young hotshots who'd graduated from Yale and had seen this path laid out for them and had taken every course in the book to prepare them for this and who knew the jargon and the way to speak. I found it terribly difficult. I had to learn an awful lot. But one thing that Marlboro did for me, and I want to give them a plug now because I'm a trustee there, is that they taught me to be an independent worker. I didn't need the accolades of large classes and lots of professors. They taught me to sit down, research something, write it, think a thought through to its end. So when it came time to write the dissertation, I actually was in better shape than students who kind of crumbled at that point. So
it also had something to do with your brains.
Well, you know, maybe.
So you were smart. Put it another way. So let me ask you this. What did you choose to write on and why?
Oh, I wrote on something called the Bloomsbury Group, which was Virginia Woolf and all of those people. I wrote a dissertation on a woman named Dora Carrington, who had at that point been a kind of forgotten member of the group.
She's been subsequently lionized in film and other places.
Well, there's a little story there.
Yes, go ahead.
Which is that after I wrote the dissertation, I tried to get it published, and somebody said, write her biography instead. And I said, okay, because I'm very dutiful. And I wrote the biography. I got published immediately. I had lots of publishing offers in two countries, and the book did fine. And then suddenly the film, which they had tried to make for years, suddenly got optioned and produced. And everyone involved with my book, my agents and my editors, all tried to contact the production company to say, can she be involved in this? And they said, we've never heard of the book. So just scroll ahead a couple of years to a cocktail party in London, and I'm standing there, and one of the actors in the film was there, and I introduced myself. And he said, oh, we all, including Emma Thompson, had pages of your book taped up around our trailers when we were filming.
Isn't that something?
So, but that's okay, you know. At the moment, it wasn't okay.
It's the way life is.
Yeah, yeah, you roll with it.
Yeah, and you get screwed a lot.
Yeah, well, there's that too.
So just let's have a little fun here and remind us of the story of Carrington.
Oh, Carrington. I've just had to write about her again. She was such an interesting woman. She was born in 1893. She came from a very sedate, conservative family, although her father was not. He'd been in India, and he was much older. She was enormously talented as an artist and went off to London to be an art student and when she was 17, and immediately cut off her hair and did all those things that young women did in that era, right before the First World War, right after it, and fell in love with a gay man named Lytton Strachey, and she spent the rest of her life with him. He had affairs. She actually married and had affairs, but they did live.
He had gay affairs.
He had gay affairs.
Right.
She had both.
Yes.
But mainly men, but yes, at least one documented lesbian affair, but she remained true to him. He was the rock for her life, and when he died of stomach cancer, she was 39.
Wow.
She shot herself.
That's right.
It was kind of awful. Yeah. And I was able to go back to the house and stand where she'd shot herself and talk to people who had known her and had had to deal with the aftermath. And it became very, very real.
Who was around to be proud of you after you got your PhD?
Who was around? My parents were there. My kids were there. My husband was there. I, in all the pictures, seem to have been there, but I don't remember it very well, except I was smiling a lot. And I didn't know where to go and ended up here, oddly enough. I had been working at Stanford, and Toni Morrison was the Schweitzer professor at Albany, at the university. And she didn't offer it to me, but she said, if you come here and come teach here for a year, I'll work with you. And my husband was offered a job in Albany area. So we said, okay, this might be a good thing since our sustainable life in Palo Alto wasn't going to last much longer if we needed a bigger house. Of course, if I'd kept the house, I'd be a multimillionaire now. But
indeed.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's how I ended up here.
Not quite so with the house in Albany.
No?
No.
Well, I just sold a house in Vermont, so I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Okay. So you come to Albany. There's Toni Morrison, the great Toni Morrison.
Yeah.
And does that work out? Does she mentor you?
She does. She does. I went off and taught at Skidmore for 3 years.
I remember that.
And still she and I would meet and talk, and it was a wonderful time. And then I went off to do a study abroad program for Skidmore, and my kids came with me. And she called me in London and said, would you like to come teach at Princeton for a year with me? I'm going to Princeton. And you don't say no. So I had been offered the job at Vassar and asked if they would just hold it for a year so I could go off and sit at the knee of Toni Morrison and Cornel West and all of those people who were there at that time.
And what was Princeton like? I mean, you talked a little, you were nice about Harvard, but
I was sort of nice about Harvard.
Yeah.
Princeton, at that point, I'd found my feet. You know, I had a Stanford degree. I held my head up. I didn't feel in any way like a second-class citizen, and no one there made me feel that way. And I was just there for a year. The students were pretty interesting. They were so driven. I'd not quite seen students so driven. Students who would not go home for Thanksgiving because they had papers to write. I'd never quite seen students who didn't want to have a good time. You know.
Princeton and Harvard were different in terms of the student body, right?
Yeah, I think so. They were different things. I mean, Princeton had those dining clubs.
Yeah.
And the one thing I didn't like about it was they gave me a lovely apartment, but it was in one of the dormitories.
Yeah.
And I had passed that point in my life, and I didn't like people setting off the fire alarms at 3 in the morning. And, you know, it was a different life for me. But it was, I'd have to say, it was life-changing. It was life-altering. It was a year where I always felt I was in the presence of genius. And
you saw the great scientists and walking the halls. Let me ask you this. You know, I remember that there was a point at which the Princeton kids were pretty aggressive about saying, we want people of color, you know, here. Did you feel any of that?
No, I didn't feel that. I didn't really feel part of that. I was there as a kind of peripheral person. I do know students who have just graduating from Princeton now, and they do still feel that that way now. And often they became overachievers as well.
Interesting.
I think there is something about being intelligent, African-American, and ambitious that really drives certain people very hard.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in a bad way, but very hard.
I have a 38-year-old daughter who is a Princeton PhD, and very interesting about her reactions to the town itself. A little bit different from...
What does she think?
She's associate professor of political science at the College of New Jersey, TCNJ, and I would say has really distinguished herself. But it's interesting that you know that people function in that environment and can sort of divide their academic experience with, as you say, the eating clubs.
It is a different. It was a different kind of town. I didn't feel entirely comfortable in the town. It was so well-heeled. It was so, I don't know what's the word, patrician. It was a brilliant, wonderful university with wonderful opportunities.
Absolutely.
But I never would have felt comfortable living there, I think.
So now you leave Princeton, and then what happens?
Oh, where did I go from there? I went off to Vassar, 14 years.
14 years at Vassar. And where did that fit in the great paradigm of characterizing academic institutions?
Well, you know, Vassar now and Vassar then were, they were on a continuum. Under the new president, she's made this huge push to bring in people from a variety of incomes and backgrounds. Vassar was on its way up, and it had been trying to beautify its campus, and it was still dealing with Poughkeepsie. You know, it's in Poughkeepsie. But it was... Vassar was a mixed bag for me. It gave me a really good sense of what a good, strong liberal arts college could be. I had wonderful colleagues, and I was allowed to do whatever kind of research and scholarship I wanted to do. And that's where I was able to publish and write a couple of books. And they gave me the funding. They gave me the time. They some places, as you may know, really want you to stay in one thing. You want to do one thing. But they allowed me to write biography, but also to do research on Black British history, and also allowed me to come here and do the radio show.
But you were doing, right? You were doing academic research, which is always so high in terms of success. I mean, I think I was a pretty good professor at New Paltz for all of those years. But the most important thing you could do, even if you weren't such a good teacher, was to publish something.
Yeah, it was great. The publishing part was terrific. But you know what? I think it was the teaching part that I found most rewarding. The students, just to get into a classroom with a bunch of students and help them work their way through a problem or an issue or a book, to help them change or confirm their beliefs, all of that was really tremendously exciting to me.
And it was great because they were bright, right?
They were bright. They were bright. And the ones who were struggling, I spent a lot of time with them one-on-one. So I always felt that that was the biggest contribution. The kids didn't care that much whether I wrote a book or not. I cared.
Yeah.
The administration cared. But they really wanted someone who could help them understand things and to find their way in the world and to do it through their intellects. And it was terrific.
How about, since we're professor to professor here, how about the politics of the situation? I must say, the one thing I love about not being a professor anymore is not having to go to committee meetings and wanting to kill somebody. So,
no, you're just talking to someone who's taken on a huge administrative job. So it wasn't the meetings thing. I don't think I miss grading papers.
Oh, yeah.
That part.
If you said to all of us, one and two, it would be meetings and papers.
That's right. And there are meetings and there are meetings. There are meetings at which things get accomplished. And those are the kind of meetings I hope that I run now, that we don't hold a meeting to 2 hours if we've accomplished everything we need to say in an hour.
But you didn't get into a fist fight with anybody, did you?
No.
I did.
Did you?
Yeah. Hold me back.
You know, professors tend to do that. I've seen a number of instances where security was called and where...
No, that didn't happen here.
Yeah, no. But that people, they used to say people, academics fight more and more because the stakes are so low.
Stakes are so low.
Right.
A quote that has been attributed to at least 5,000 people.
At least.
Yeah.
And most of them professors.
So there you are. And you said you were writing books. What's your style of writing? I mean, how do you write?
You know, it's an interesting thing. It was a very freeing thing. The last book I wrote, the Mrs. Prince book, it was the first time I wrote a book with no footnotes. And it was so freeing. I suddenly thought, you know, there was no little number to make you stop and look it up in the back. We had blind footnotes, which means the footnotes existed in the back, but you had to kind of figure out that they were there and go look for them because you have to prove that you actually had the facts. But I like to write in a way that appeals to a broader audience. I don't see myself as writing for an academic audience. I hope they appreciate and like it, but I really want people to be moved by what I have to say or what I've discovered. I want them to want to keep reading. I want the sentences to feel like something you wanted to open a book up and read. And when I wrote the Prince book, and there's a great story in there, but when I wrote that book, it was written 5 times. I mean, I make students rewrite and rewrite, but I'd never been in that position myself. And my editor said, you know, we want this to read almost like a novel. We don't want you to write, you know, the history of the Pocumptic Valley. We don't want you to put all the battle scenes in. What we want you to do is tell the story about these people that will move people to tears. And so she kept crossing out things, and I went back and I went back and I went back. It took 7 years. Every book I've written has taken 7 years. I don't know.
Really?
Yes, yes. You have to really want to live with these people.
So do you have postpartum when you're done with the book?
Yes. Yes. There is a funny story. I wrote the biography of Frances Hodgson Burnett. She wrote The Secret Garden. And her...
Certainly one of my favorite books.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. I have to get out of that industry because then I went on and did the annotated Secret Garden and I did the Norton Critical Edition and I...
And you did Oz. Didn't you do Oz?
I didn't, but I collect Oz books, so I'm right in there. So her descendants, her great-granddaughter and her husband came to visit us. And we were friends at this point. And I heard my husband and her husband in the kitchen talking. And her husband said, so, you've been living with Frances for 7 years now. What's that like? And my husband said, well, it's been 7 long years and I would like my wife back. And there is a sense, it must be like being an actor and doing the same Broadway show or play, you know, week in and week out. You immerse yourself so much in their lives that by the time you're done with them and you kill them off, which you have to do at the end, it's both a relief and the sense that you haven't really got it right.
Listen, Gretchen Gresina, you're talking now about one of my favorite books, and during the fun drives, I often read the last several pages.
Oh, good for you.
To make people cry. And what did you find out about this author and how she came up with this priceless tale?
Well, there are funny things there, too, because she wrote that book when she was at the latter part of her life. She actually wrote 53 novels. Most of them were for adults. Some of them I like a great deal, some I don't. She had 2 failed marriages. She had 2 kids she adored, but one of them died when he was 16 in her arms of tuberculosis. So she wrote this book, I think, as a way to resurrect her son, to make him kind of come back to life and be cured.
Makes great sense.
It does. But when she wrote this book, she wrote it as a kind of Christmas book that would sell well, but she said it had a special place in her heart. But she never in a million years thought it was a book that would survive, nor did her friends. Nobody thought. Everyone thought that the thing she was going to be known for, where there were 2 books, Little Lord Fauntleroy, which she wrote in 1886.
I have no idea.
And it was like the Harry Potter of its time.
Sure.
And all these people said they hated her because their mothers made them wear these lace collars and, you know, because of her. And a book toward the end of her life called The Dawn of a Tomorrow, which no one has ever read or heard of. And they, in fact, went to do in Central Park, way up 105th Street, went to do a memorial for her after she died. And they wanted the statue to be of the dawn of a tomorrow. And people said, well, I don't know, it might be more interesting to do that secret garden thing and have Colin and Dickon and Mary out there. And so that's what ended up happening. But people fought it. They actually fought it with the Parks Department because they thought it wasn't going to be a special book. And it was the children who made the book famous. They didn't let it die. And librarians as well. They all said, you know, you might like this book. So people who wrote about children's books never included her. And then all of a sudden, the kids just kept it going and going. I have my copy from the 60s.
The movie has come out twice now.
At least, yeah.
The first one, of course, was terrific, I thought. The second one was terrible.
Margaret O'Brien in the first one? Yeah, she was terrific.
Yeah. That was really good.
Yeah.
And what's your fascination with Oz?
Well, Oz. My grandparents had bought Oz books for my uncle, who started collecting them. And then when I came along years and years later, they had all these Oz books, and I just started reading them. I thought, whoa, they're so wonderful. Yeah. And there's one after the other after the other. Yeah. They went on. Do you know L. Frank Baum tried to stop those books? He just said, you know, I've been doing these damn books for many years, and I am tired of doing an Oz book a year. And then all the kids wrote him and said, no, we have to have another Oz book. So they just kept rolling them out and then took over with two other authors after he stopped and died, and someone else took it over and someone else took it over. And I just seemed to have them all.
Great.
Yeah.
Now you identify with Ozma. You not?
Somebody was fixing my personal email account the other day and called in to the tech support, and they asked him what the email address was, and he mentioned Ozma, and the tech guy said, oh, you mean like the Princess of Oz? And I said, well, we got to keep that account, because if this guy knows this, it was quite amazing. Most people don't know that story, because the Princess of Oz used to be a boy, and they turned... He had been enchanted, and they turned him into a girl. It's a very gender-bending book.
It's interesting because the wizard sort of...
Yeah, he fades away. He fades away. He becomes less interesting over time.
But Ozma and Dorothy is the story.
And Glinda, the women rule Oz.
Yeah. So you have a lot of fun doing this work.
I do. I often have a lot of fun. I do a lot of very serious work. I mean, my book on Black Britain has really stayed alive in Black Britain in the 18th century. In fact, I heard something about that topic this morning on BBC.
And the central thesis of Black Britain was?
Well, I wanted to go back and resurrect the fact that there were Black people in Britain in the 18th century, that it wasn't just a story of Wilberforce coming along later and abolishing slavery, that there was a whole world and a whole life and a whole problematic history. So I actually had been in London doing some research and went into a bookshop to ask about a new book on Black British history. And the woman looked at me and said, Madam, there were no Black people in Britain before the Second World War.
Sure.
So I just said, okay, I'm going to go home and write a book about that. And it stayed alive. It's been out for a long, long time, decades. But it's led to my being on television a number of times. I just came back from doing a 10-part BBC series on Britain's Black Past. In the 18th and 19th century, I traveled all over Britain interviewing people in generally dreadful British weather, I have to say, outside, and finding incredible stories that people still don't know about. In fact, there are white British people who have Black ancestors and have no idea.
So tell us one that will surprise us.
Well, here's one. I went to see a house in Wales where had been a huge mansion in the late 18th century. The guy owned three plantations in Antigua. His mother had been a plantation owner. His father had willed him all this and brought him back from Antigua, educated him in London, and made him his heir because he had only female heirs, and this guy was not legitimate. So it was a big deal. He got all this money, built this huge estate, became a magistrate and a sheriff, and he was Black.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
And the really interesting thing is you want to get inside the head of a guy like that. And then to find out that his descendants 200 years later live in Australia, have just revered their wonderful ancestor who had this incredible career and life. There are no portraits. And they didn't know. They didn't know their ancestor was mixed race. And some of them embraced it. And most of them just got very quiet and didn't like it at all. But there are stories like that.
That's a great story.
Isn't it? I think I should write a book about it.
Yeah. I do. So tell us a little about some of the other books.
Well, Mr. and Mrs. Prince, I want to go back to that for a moment because that book was the book that moved me the most. Abijah Prince was enslaved in Northfield, Massachusetts, and he was enslaved from the time he was born in Connecticut until he was in his 50s up in Northfield. He was owned by a minister who is originally from Connecticut, a Yale graduate, in fact, when they were only about three a year. And he ended up freeing himself and finding a way to free himself, fought in the French and Indian War.
How did he free himself?
It's a complicated story, but he got some good person to buy him, and he said, I'll go join the army and I'll pay you back. So the guy wanted him to be freed, and they worked a deal.
Yeah, I see.
And then he ended up marrying a much younger woman who was living in Deerfield, Lucy Terry, who ended up being the first known African-American poet. She wasn't published for 100 years after that, and there's only one poem we know about, but we know there were others. And so I wanted to write their story because they moved to Vermont, got 100 acres, built this place. People tried to run them off their land. They went to court over and over. And I thought they were just fascinating people. But 2 years into the research, I did two wonderful things, as it turned out to be wonderful. One was to tell my husband to come help me with the research. He's not an academic. He was a business guy. And he said, okay. And he just proved to be wonderful at research. But the other thing was I started researching the family of the man who owned Abijah Prince.
Gotcha.
And discovered that all these names were looking familiar. And I thought, this is very odd. So I went to my mother, who's a genealogist, and I said, get out all your research and help me with this. And lo and behold, as I actually say in the book, I'm descended from the white man who owned Abijah Prince.
And you had no idea?
None. None whatsoever. People thought I wrote the book because of this connection, but it was the most... I write in the book that it was like being invited to dinner at somebody's house and sitting down at the table and realizing you're in the wrong house. And you thought, I'm not descended from these slaves. I'm descended from the white people who owned these slaves. And what were the chances of that? So it wasn't a direct descendant. My ancestor was his sister. Close enough. So it took off from there. At that point, we began to find everything. It was like there was a closed book that nobody had been able to crack. And then once I discovered this, it was as though they said, you have to go tell our story, and we chose you. And I said, okay, I'll write this book.
Well, Gretchen Gozzino, 7 years on each book.
Yeah.
And my question to you is, why not eight? When do you decide, okay, this is the last sentence?
Well, partly, there's always a danger that you won't like the people anymore, so you have to stop before you get to that point. There's also the sense that your editor says you have a contract, and we're drawing the line. And there's also a sense that there's no more I can say at this moment. Uh-huh. And, you know, so with the Prince book, it was done, it was finished. And, of course, after it was published, I started hearing from people and someone actually tracked their descendants. And you wish it had happened at the time, but it's a great coda to an interesting story.
Now, here's where I always get into trouble. You're now a dean.
I am.
And the classic definition that I learned of a dean when I was at Rutgers was a mouse studying to be a rat. And so, and people take great offense at that, and I don't know why. But do you have to be a meanie?
I think you have to do things that are difficult to do.
What?
Well, I've only been there 2 weeks, so I haven't had to do that.
Tenure?
Well, I don't have to worry about tenure because the Honors College doesn't have its own tenured faculty. People actually, you know, it's a different situation. But there are times when I was deaning when I would have to be responsible for letting people go.
Sure.
Or for not, you know, telling people that what they were doing was wrong and that we have to find a way to stop that.
I'm sorry, that's pregnant.
Well, to say, well, I can't say because, you know, this is confidential, but there are times when you have to say to someone, someone's complained about you.
Oh, I see.
A student's complained about you. We have to talk about this and figure out how to handle this.
Well, now, wait a second. You're a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. We've just had a new law passed for SUNY.
Yeah.
It says that basically you have to give consent before you have sex.
Right.
And there's a huge debate about whether this is going to work or not for a lot of reasons.
Right.
What do you make of it?
That's a big one, and it's a huge question. I think the Title IX thing comes into it, where we now have to tell people if they want to confess things to you that I'm going to stop you right there because anything you tell me, I have to pass on. And it's, but in terms of the yes means yes or no means no situation, I haven't actually had to deal with that yet. I assume I will because this is a residential college and there will be instances of things that come up. I will say that I had very strong feelings about the Columbia case, sure, where the young man was vilified, and even though he had been cleared, his life was changed. And I know that turning that into an art project and a thesis, I think, could be problematic. I think, you know, we're not in the room with those two people.
Indeed.
And I would find it very difficult to decide as an academic, you know, to have a faculty administrative panel that decides things that courts decide in the bigger world. That's a huge problem, I think.
Could you go a little further on that?
Well, I haven't had to deal with it yet, but yeah. I do think that academics haven't necessarily, and administrators haven't necessarily been trained about the proper lines of questioning and judicial process.
Sure.
And that for so long have been put in the position of making decisions about people's lives that go way beyond honor code infractions and, you know, that sort of thing, to lines of questioning that they have not been professionally trained to take on. So in terms of, clearly sexual assault is real and it happens.
Sure.
In Dartmouth, where I've just left, it convened a huge, long study about that and has tried to find ways to try to deal with that problem. It is a big problem. Alcohol on campuses is a huge problem, and we often find that those two things are connected without necessarily trying to assign blame.
Tell us a little bit, Gretchen Gersina, about the Honors Program and what you're doing with it.
Oh, it's a wonderful place. There was an Honors Program at UMass for many years, and then in 1999, the state decided that they were going to develop an entire Honors College. There are similar ones at Rutgers has an Honors College, the Douglas College. Other places have them. And they built an entire college which would give students a private education experience, but within the context of a public university, meaning that they take classes with all the other students, but they have also a certain number of honors classes that are small and more intense. They write a thesis. They have a lot of that more, I'm not going to use the word elite, but a stronger sense of being part of a more intense enterprise. So they built 2 years ago, the Massachusetts legislature, after they had put the Honors College at Amherst, they chose that as the campus, they built a $188 million residential college. And that's what I've walked into now. Is this place is only 2 years old. The building, the facilities, students have living and learning communities. They take courses across the board in their departments. They have regular majors, but they also have an honors experience in a living and learning community, which is open to everyone. Once you're in the Honors College, all events in your college or your dorm are open to the entire campus. So they don't feel entirely separated from the rest of the university. They're taking classes with other students, but they also have these intense honors classes that give them a real, I think, leg up in the world.
Now that's a great sentence, and I want to go with it for a moment. Give them a leg up in the world. I'm fascinated by this because, you know, I've known some very bright kids in my life who did well academically, but they haven't done that well in the outside world. One wonders whether these are good predictors.
You know, I'm wondering about all sorts of predictors. We now know that SAT scores aren't necessarily the predictors of academic success. We know that writing an honors thesis doesn't necessarily get you the job you want, but it teaches you the skills that you need to be an independent team player at the same time. Those two things seem contradictory, but they're not, that you can do independent work, but you can also work closely with a professor. And that teaches you skills you need to go out into the world and get a job. They lead to internships, which can be good. They can be controversial. They lead to a sense of pride, I would think. And they have fewer of the large classes that a lot of students take. You know, UMass used to be considered a safety school. Those days are gone. And we want the Honors College to attract those students who might think, you know, I got into Wellesley. I got into Boston College. But I think this Honors College experience at UMass is going to give me something special, and I will go there instead. That's what we want to do.
You're on the radio right now, and a lot of people are duly impressed, which they should be and have been for years with the book show, which you did so well. So there's a difference between talking to 10,000 people and there's a difference with talking to a class, you know, of 12 people or 30 people. What does it mean to you to have a public audience?
You know, you have a pulpit. You have a way of exposing people to ideas and thoughts that are, I think, important. That's why I loved doing the book show. I thought books were important. The ideas they expressed were important. But I never felt that I had an audience of 10,000. I'm always surprised when people say,
That's
I heard
right.
you.
You don't. You think we're talking right to
we're
each other.
We're sitting
That's
here
it.
In a room yeah. talking to each other. I don't know. 12 people in a room, actual physical people, are more intimidating.
That's right. They are. Yeah. So when you're teaching a class, I always liked big classes. And the reason I like them is because I figured, you know, your odds of getting talkers in a bigger class were better than your odds of getting talkers in a smaller class. Maybe that's naive, but I always felt that, you know, you got 200 kids in a room, you were going to get a couple of people who really knew how to talk.
Those are low odds, Alan. I've got to say that the odds of having in a 200-person class, the odds of having 10% of them sleeping are pretty good.
Yeah.
The odds of having them on their laptops and phones are pretty high. I actually used to walk around a room and close laptops as I went by when I noticed they were on Facebook.
Love it. When I saw somebody yawn, I would say Freud said a yawn was a sign of repressed rage.
That get them going?
Well, and I said, and I know what the repressed rage is. It's listening to me.
Well, you know, there is the stand and deliver thing. Yeah. I think they're trying to find ways of making large classes more interactive and all of that. You do sometimes get the sense, I know you did, that you were tap dancing on a tabletop trying to get them to be engaged.
What makes a great professor?
Enthusiasm.
It is, isn't it?
I think so. Caring about the thing that you cared enough about to bring to them and you want them to care. That's the start of it all, don't you think?
I do. I know this is a show about you, but my students from the 1970s gave me a party. I brought them all into a room and talked about what I had meant to their education and the Legislative Gazette and, you know, and the projects. And I was so taken with that. It really, you talked number one as your kids, no question about it. But boy, that was pretty impressive to me.
And do you have students who come back years later and tell you?
Oh, yeah.
How much you meant to them.
That's what this was.
Yeah.
And the college president from New Paltz was there, and they were talking to him, and he was saying, boy, they have incredible things to say about you. So that was something.
It's a legacy, Alan. You know, there's a legacy that books give you,
yeah.
that, you know, they live on past you. But there's also a legacy because if you teach a student well, their children are going to benefit from that as well, too. And it moves generationally. It's a really inspiring thing.
Garrison Keillor came in here one day. He was sitting there, and he looked at me in my office, and he said, so have you ever written a book? I said, oh, yeah, I wrote two books. He said, what were they? I said, well, this last one is Me and Mario, which did quite well. And then before that, I wrote in the 1960s, Strengthening the Wisconsin Legislature. I thought this guy was going to fall over. And I was sure it was going to show up in a monologue somewhere. But that book got me tenure.
Well, that's right. That's what you needed to do.
Yeah.
You know, I interviewed him once on the book show.
Yes.
And he asked me how many books a year I had to do for the show. And I said, 50, 52. And he said, good Lord, woman. And I just remember that the mask dropping for a moment, you know, with him. I thought he was great.
He is great. And he's very funny. Because I said to him, what's with this almanac? You know, what is this almanac thing? Everybody else has an almanac. He said, he looked at me and he said, is that right? I didn't know that.
That's what happens when you live in Minnesota.
Baloney. You know, I mean, and for a moment there, he had me. So that's what he does. So we have a minute left. I just wanted to ask you this, Gretchen. We're all very proud of you and what you've accomplished. It's just extraordinary. And I just hope you have the ability to enjoy that.
I would like to. And I think that being able to get up and go to work and say, this is what I would like to be doing today,
yeah.
is an important thing. I think having vacations is probably also a really good thing because in the end, you know, you do get a bit tired.
We've been in conversation today with Gretchen Holbrook-Gazina, former host of The Book Show on WAMC, current dean of the Commonwealth Honors College at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. For more information about Professor Gazina, head to her website, www.gretchengazina, and it's GRETCHENGERZINA.com. Gretchen Gazina, I can't tell you how we love you and how much we appreciate your coming over here and doing the show with us.
I can't tell you how much I love being back. Thank you, Alan.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.